Well, I'd like to begin by thanking you for both taking the time to sit down and talk about the history of the White Rock Museum. Maybe start with your personal histories, your interests in museums, how that started, and what brought you to the White Rock Museum.
I'll start, I guess. I was invited to be on the board of directors back in 2007 and joined then, and we were undertaking raising funds to restore this or create a better climate for a museum. And that took a few years, so it was a good 5 years before we were able to come up with the funding. And then overseeing the new building being created and the challenges of storing our collection, and then finally beginning as a real museum after so many years of being in place and doing museum work in a very difficult, challenging space. So then after 6 years, our executive director stepped down and she felt that I would be a good fit with my background in history, even though I don't have a museum education. And I was thrilled to have the role because I do see an exciting future for our museum. I think that we've been kind of going about it in a hobbyist way, and now it's becoming much more professional, and we did our strategic plan last summer, and I really like the new focus that we have here. So
yourself?
Mine's going to be a little longer because my museum history has been longer. I actually went to UBC, and I've got a bachelor in art history and anthropology, and then did a master in anthropology at the Museum of Anthropology. So my training is in museum work right from university times. I actually did an exhibit, curated an exhibit as my graduate project. And then I had to write a paper because they didn't know how to grade an exhibit. So
I think
it took
they do
a very
now.
Long time. Yeah, exactly. But I was one of the on the forefront of the trying to do an exhibit for graduate work. Person, so trailblazer here.
Yeah. There must have been a little bit of doubt.
It took me a long time. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There were times when I was going to give up, because it took a very long time to get my master's degree. But as a result, I actually worked quite a bit at the Museum of Anthropology in all kinds of different areas. Worked in the gift shop, gave tours, was the receptionist for about 3 years. Wow. Coordinated their barbecues that they do for big conferences that they do out. I don't know if they still do them, but they did at that time, big conference barbecues for people who had like booked conferences on campus could come and have like an evening and kind of be in the big houses and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
Anyways, so I was there for like and got quite integrated with the staff at the Museum of Anthropology. Still know lots of people there.
Mm.
And from there, I got hired by the Alberni Valley Museum in Port Alberni and worked there as their curator under Jean McIntosh for about 3.5 years. And Port Alberni was just a little too small, a little too remote for me. So I was looking for opportunities in a bigger place, and took a position with the Alberta Museums Association in Edmonton. And that sort of played off an area. My area of sort of where I get kind of most excited is collections management, information management, automation. I'm a computer nerd. I have owned a computer since like 1981. Moved to Alberta, worked with the Alberta Museum Association. At first I was hired by the University of Alberta, but through Alberta Museums Association money, basically to run what was being called, I can't even remember what it was being called at that time. It's kind of like the chin of Alberta. Maine, the Museums Alberta Information Network.
Mm.
Yes. So I did that, and then actually became a staff member of the association when the grant money that had me at the University of Alberta ran out. Kind of had done everything in the Museum Association thing. I'd been, I helped them automate their own, like the association's work, and got them on good databases for membership and that kind of stuff. worked, you know, helping to rejig their whole grants program, because in Alberta, the Museum Association is a grant gifting. It does it on behalf of the province. Mm-hmm. And then I just decided to, again, start looking for work, and became the director of the Ukrainian Cultural Heritage Village in just outside of Edmonton, and did that for just about 2 years. But then there was an opening within the same department, because it's part of the provincial government of Alberta, and within the cultural heritage area, they needed somebody to be in charge of what is mostly the seasonal sites. So, but some of the sites go all year. So there was Rutherford House and Stephenson House and St. George. Sorry, I'm running off here. Follacombe Chapel, anyways, Buckingham House, and also the Oil Sands Discovery Center, which is also one of the ones that goes all year. So we're like six museums, one interpretive center that I kind of became the director of coordinating.
All simultaneously.
Wow. But I mean, I had staff
doing,
like, you know, working under me. And I don't know how to say this on, like, yeah, with the thing running. I was going to move back to Vancouver with whatever, the man of my dreams,
mm-hmm.
and things went bad.
Yeah.
So I had resigned my position when things kind of all fell apart.
Yeah.
And then I had to kind of scramble for other work. So I did some contract work for a while with the, it's in Wetaskiwin, the Reming, oh. It's, yeah, not the Remington, that's the Carriage Museum. I'm forgetting the name of the guy. It's the big car museum in Wetaskiwin. I worked there for like 2 years.
It'll come some, yes, at some
exactly.
point in time.
But anyways, yeah, mornings are not my best time. I don't usually even come in today. But anyways,
well, I appreciate
sorry.
It. And also, I will say but, that I do edit the
yes,
audio.
Thank
so
you.
It,
yeah.
It,
so
it,
please don't put this
on
air. Because I sound like a babbling idiot. But also,
Alberta. From what I understand, Alberta's an interesting model, almost for a national approach to museum.
Well,
they seem quite ahead of the curve.
Well,
in some ways,
BC was there and got rid of their whole heritage. I mean, BC used to run a lot of the museum. Like Bakersville used to be a BC heritage museum, and BC divested itself about the time I left. So about like 19 years ago, 18, 19 years ago, BC Heritage divested itself of all of the museums that it ran as a network of provincial museums.
That,
it used to have a network.
That makes sense, because looking
and
at
BC
the...
was idiotic in terms of, because a lot of those museums have struggled. Some of them may have even closed down. I can't even remember all of the names of all of the ones that used to be part of the BC Heritage portfolio.
Yeah.
But I knew a number of people who kind of ended up, you know, losing their jobs because basically the museum that they were running became a, you know, private concern and got divested to somebody else. So,
Because there's a flurry of activity. There's a paper trail enough to suggest that there were initiatives at that time, and then it sort of altered. But
I mean, they literally were being run out of the British Columbia government. And then they, for whatever reason, decided that they weren't in the museum running business anymore, and shut it all down.
Wow.
At a
transitional period for museum practice, it seems, as well.
Yeah,
like,
'cause
a time,
I mean, like that.
You know, when cataloging and digitizing collections would have been.
Yeah, because that would have been the same time that Chin was starting to pull out of running everybody's collection management for them and was forcing museums to undertake. And that's basically what paid my bills for quite a while, because that was part of my advisory service, was to try and provide museums with good information about what kind of software to look for and how to actually digitize their collection. I was lucky enough to take a couple courses from the UVic, Cultural Resource Management. So I took information management from Jim Blackaby, who's like, you know, famous in the museum world for, you know, doing the nomenclature book. Mm-hmm. And he also taught a course in like digitization in both photography as well as like information management stuff. So yeah, it was a really transitional time in terms of museums taking on a lot of the sort of the information management needs and the computer sort of automation of that.
So you were doing you were doing freelance for a period of time and then got involved with the White Rock Museum.
Well, yeah, I did some freelance. No, and then I took a year where I was actually a property manager, so I had nothing to do with museum stuff. But it was while I was still back in Wetaskiwin. But the grant money that was keeping me occupied at the Wetaskiwin Museum ran out, and so I kind of had to come up with something fairly quickly and became And that there was a number of incidents that happened while I was property management, like really bad things like suicide and actually a guy who, and it's still, you can find it on the interwebs, a guy who was in a standoff with the RCMP and my, and it was the building I was living in plus one of the buildings that, like I lived in the building that, one of the three buildings that I was responsible for. And so basically the guy was shot. He wasn't killed, but you know, I did suffer some trauma as a result of, I mean, not just that incident, but it was a whole bunch of incidents all stacked on top of each other. And it just kind of, you know, I had to take a bit of time to recover, but also just didn't want to go back at the level I had been working. Like it was a case of reassessing my life and, you know, like that whole what's important to you. So I moved back here to be closer to my parents. My parents had gone through some health issues. They're getting older. So, I mean, it was kind of a whole bunch of things that brought me back to the Lower Mainland. And then 2 years ago, I started working on the board here. And it was, and that was really great because it was right about the time when I was, you know, like wanting to flex that muscle again in terms of the museum stuff. And I recognized that this museum was right on that cusp of, you know, Karen had just been hired, like within probably whatever,
maybe a year.
Yeah, a year
less
of
than
when
a year.
I started. And so she was pushing the museum in the right in the right direction, and I kind of was like, this woman needs a bit of support.
Really good to have somebody with
she needs, you know, and the expertise. Like I was one of the, I was the first board member that they had who actually had like museum training and deep knowledge. Sorry, that didn't sound. I have deep knowledge of museum stuff, but I do. Anyways,
it's really benefited us because
so
we
I
have
was
been
just
struggling.
Kind of working,
so
working with the board and sort of kind of getting all jazzed up again about working with the museum that was kind of at the right spot to be, you know, to benefit from, you know, someone with a perspective, someone who wanted to go that direction and then needed the support to say, yes, she's right. Yes, listen to this person.
And it's scalable.
And, yeah, exactly.
Because right? It's all about getting a project plan together. Mm-hmm. Like what's the timeline for making that transition?
Mm-hmm.
The logistics of that.
Yeah. So
must have been refreshing to also work at a different scale.
It was,
like,
yeah.
You know,
actually, it was exactly the right thing because I'd actually been trying in the interim, like in the sort of 4 year period after the property manager, even while I was doing that, trying to get work in museums, but at a not a director level anymore. Like I didn't want to be, you know, the boss. I didn't want to be responsible for everything. I was, you know, a little burned out from that and. You know, curatorial and collections management is my first love. And it actually has been a thread, even when I was at the director level, I sat on the collections management policy team to create the policy for the Alberta, like my name's in the book, that's the Alberta policy for museum collections, because I, like, you know, sort of begged to be on that committee to do that.
That's from what I understand, that's one of the only province-wide accession policies in Canada, is it? Is that still the case?
Well, I don't know about in Canada, because some of the smaller provinces on the East Coast do some collaborative things amongst their museums, and Nova Scotia has a whole provincial network, but the scale is, like, not
right
close at all. You know, so what Nova Scotia kind of does within their little, because they also have a provincial network of museums there, but as I say, like, we're big too little. I mean, the collection size of the province of Alberta is massive. It's bigger than the University of Alberta's, which is, I think, the second largest publicly held collection in Alberta, which then dwarfs the Glenbow's collection. You know, like, it, the province's one is massive because it encompasses everything from, you know, all of the archaeological material, because that is by law has to be turned over to the province. You know, the Tyrrell, all of the paleontological stuff. The province of Alberta, the Royal Alberta Museum now, does a lot of natural history stuff on top of human history stuff. So yeah, it's totally massive. And then there's all the sub sites, the living history museums, like, you know, the Ukrainian Cultural Heritage Center, and then all of the, you know, the fort sites that I looked after, and, you know, blah 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 blah.
It's massive.
Yeah, head smashed in Buffalo Jump, World UNESCO site. Yeah, all of that's part of the province.
With regards to the White Rock collection, what were its beginnings? How did it start?
Most of the collection is comprised of Irene McLeod, who was a resident of White Rock for, I guess, a quarter of a century. And she was a divorcee, quite an eccentric figure in the community, and traveled the world and would bring home pieces. And upon her death, she bequeathed her home and its contents to the city on condition that they make it a museum. The house wasn't viable as a museum, and she had a lot of materials. But she really wanted to leave that legacy. And in fact, 2 years ago, our summer exhibit was about Irene's place and her need to leave this legacy. And it's interesting because most of the pieces she's purchased have been appraised by art collectors and dismissed as not being worth anything. But it depends on what you look as worth. Like, this is a woman who really made a mark on this community, and her legacy exists today because of her determination to do that for White Rock. So pieces have gone missing, as we've talked a little bit about how this museum has transitioned and been moved in various locations, and the efforts of Lorraine Ellenwood to make sure it lasts and is maintained as a museum. So that's where this museum began.
Yeah, and again, from some of my readings as well, the museum was formulated, I mean, yes, they received that collection, but at a time not long after the centennial. I mean, you'll hear this in community museums across Canada. I mean, it's not even unique to BC or Alberta. I mean, the number of museums in Alberta that started between, like, 1967 and 1972 is just, like, you know, like most of them. And I think some of that same energy was part of the energy that started this place too, because just people were thinking about heritage and what it meant and saving Canadian stuff. And
do you find distinct mandate changes in looking at the White Rock collection, focuses at certain times that altered, or maybe under the direction of certain figures, high concentration of one sort of thing over another?
I don't have a museum background, but our former curator, Kate, was really really strong in assisting me and helping me understand things. And I do believe that in recent years we've become more mindful about what we're collecting and what we're pulling in and what we're turning away. The pier is very important. Last year there was a big storm and part of the pier was destroyed. Oh, sorry. I don't know how to do this thing. Sorry.
That's okay.
So the part of the pier was destroyed, and it was when that happened that we realized we had almost nothing in our collection, despite the fact that the pier had been built on two different occasions previously. So we arranged to get a piece of the pier for the collection, and it was we actually got two big pieces. So we worked with the city council and our liaison there, Anthony Manning, to get two large pieces and took them up to the Museum of Anthropology to be frozen so that we could store them on our offsite. And this summer, Charlene is putting together an exhibit on the pier.
Wow.
And now we have pieces.
Yeah,
with which
at least some pieces, but yeah, it'll be still largely photo documented because, we don't have a ton of stuff in terms of it. And yet the pier is, you know, that and the train station, those two things are largely responsible for the shape of White Rock as it stands today, you know, in terms of its development as a city.
The development of the museum and the archives, were they something that happened concurrently? And how do they relate with one another? Or do they kind of feed off of one another in terms of building exhibitions? How do you make use of them?
I would say they feed off each other. I know that, I mean, they're at opposite ends of the building, but our curator and our archivist work together when they're developing exhibits. And both, you know, Hugh has been here forever, and he's just a tremendous resource of information. Just, he can tell the stories. He's grown up here spent so much time as reading the newspapers and finding old photographs. And so Kate and now Charlene rely on him a lot when they're building exhibits to get that innate information from the community to help tell the story.
Yeah.
And the story there was his mom was involved in
farming the museum. I mean, at the time that it was becoming sort of a, like a real museum.
Yeah, so it has an institutional memory there.
And she literally wrote the book that is the White Rock community history. I mean, she's the sort of the community. If the community was going to say, who's the historian of White Rock, it would be her.
Lorraine,
yeah. Mm.
Do you actively acquire items for the collection? You were mentioning in terms of making choices.
Yeah, it's a bit new. I know Kate did some. I mean, again, like they actively acquired that piece of the pier because she identified that it would be, I mean, A, that we didn't have stuff like that, but also that it was historically significant and worth saving. But I think that we have been, you know, mostly in the past in that sort of the passive collecting kind of model. Just waiting for people to come, I was on the way to the dump and I thought of you. Like, that's my favorite saying is that happens so many times in Port Alberni. I haven't really had people say that here because I think people here probably either just end up going to the dump. But I mean, yeah.
We don't need
Port
Alberni
was sort of
scenes.
Like, I literally would have people come in and go like, well, I was heading off, and most of the time it was like, just keep going. I don't want your junk. Does it have a story attached to it? But once I get sort of my feet under me, doing a bit more active collecting is on the agenda. I still need to learn the collection enough to sort of know some of the areas. But, I mean, for example, White Rock is in sort of, I mean, not the unique position, but I don't think that there are that many communities or ridings in Canada where we've had one single person be mayor, MLA, and MP, and we have here. Mm-hmm. And so Gordie Hogue was not elected in the last election, but I have sat down with him and said, I want some of your stuff.
Yeah.
I want to document, the life of he's a White Rock, born and raised person. He's got deep family history here. His father was one of the first doctors in the area. But separate even from that, under his own, you know, steam, he's lived quite a, what you'd call a historic life, regardless of what you think of his politics or anything, it's unquestionably significant, what he's achieved. So I do want to collect, you know, some of his stuff. He's famous for wearing, you know, flamboyant suits and stuff.
It's all part of it, isn't it?
So, but he has a very serious side on top of his sort of goofiness, and that's the thing that I don't think a lot of people know is kind of, you know, he's more known for his kind of like fun side, but he's super serious too, and I kind of want to get some stuff that represent, you know, like the man, the life, the history, and kind of document that. So that's already something that's on my radar, just in terms of actively collecting, because for us to have a good, you know, sort of Gordie Howe collection, it will be important in the future, because he did achieve a lot in his life. But I still need to, you know, identify some of the other, I mean, there are whole, you know, it's not technically in White Rock, but this whole peninsula, South Surrey White Rock is kind of, like, it all considers itself White Rock. But there's only one bowling alley left in this whole area. Hmm. And so I kind of want to strike up a relationship with them, too, and sort of say, you know, because I don't know that bowling alleys are dying. I still hear that some people go and do bowling. But, you know, in the off chance that we lose the last bowling alley in this area, I'd, again, like to have it, at least on their radar, to think of the museum as a place to...
Yeah, as a community center, yeah. I mean, I know that there are ones in Vancouver that have been shutting down as well, and it's one of those things, and until it's gone, you don't realize that it forms a really sort of a nucleus for people.
And again, it documents an activity that had like a strong heyday and had several comebacks. Yeah. Like, it's a kind of activity that has had like these cyclical comeback. I mean, people have sort of predicted the death of bowling alleys like several times over history.
Yeah.
And it's always come back. So I don't want to be putting a nail in his coffin right now either.
Yeah.
But it's just, again, that kind of thing that's on my radar, that there are types of businesses, you know, like you don't want to be, rooting for the end of a business, but you still need to be sort of aware of kind of how the world functions right now and where entertainment dollar goes and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I again, it's just one of those things that is on my awareness and I've kind of got my eye on. I'd have to I'd actually have to have a conversation with the Surrey Museum before I did that, because technically the bowling alley is located in Surrey, although because it's in like within three blocks, two blocks
of
yeah, you know, it's in the North Bluff area, Semiahmoo Mall area, of South Surrey, which is very close to White Rock. And so, as I say, most people who live in that area, yeah, kind of consider, like, they often say, I live in White Rock.
Interesting.
Not actively collecting right now, but it's on the radar. And in terms of the past, I'm not familiar enough with the various people who've worked in the back. I do know that one of the curators, Megan Kuss, she had some research projects done. I actually pulled down the information yesterday, so partly to prepare for this, where she had actually funding support from a, I don't know if it's still active, but a community university research organization that provided funding for two UVic students to do research on our basketry collection. Largely of which, much of the basketry collection is from Irene's, her foundational
donation. Yeah.
And she does have quite a fine basketry collection, you know, separate from like the Asian furniture and stuff like that. Her basketry collection is quite fine. It's not really attributed in terms of, you know, some of them have labels in terms of where they were picked up and that kind of thing. But most of them, there's no information as to who the maker is, but that's very common for that period. That actually was my entire master's thesis.
Mm-hmm.
Was the anonymity of women basket makers. But anyways, there have been, like, there was a project that looked at the manufacturing materials and the ecology of, you know, these baskets, And then there was another project that was basically stylistic attribution that was done in coordination with the Museum of Anthropology, working with the student from UVic.
Oh,
so there is some pretty deep research that has been done into the basketry collection. And subsequent to that, there was some other collections that we received, one from a woman named Bobs, and it's with an S, Green, who we want to do a bit more research into who she was and her connection, but she did donate quite a nice... Many of the pieces that are in the exhibit right now are from her collection of Indigenous materials. At this point, I probably wouldn't be strongly pushing the museum to collect any more Indigenous materials, just because, like, the Semiahmoo people are... I think they've got plans in the future for doing their own thing, so it's more a question of what can we do to support their work. Most of the First Nations stuff we have is not actually from this area at all. Again, in terms of many of the baskets are, some of it's Coast Salish, a lot of it's Interior Salish, New Chaluth, West Coast of Vancouver Island, that kind of thing. So not local, but we do have a fairly strong Indigenous basketry collection, probably over 200 pieces. In terms of other stuff, a lot of it's still, like, you know, your domestic, sort of settler stuff, and some toys. Did quite a bit of I don't know if that was active collecting as well, or it was mostly just as a result of putting on an exhibit, more stuff came in.
Right.
But I'm trying to think of other sort of strong areas of particular note in the collection.
Well, even with the Sandcastle exhibit last year, we acquired the trophy.
Yeah, I mean, and that ended up being, again, that sort of combination of active... actually, there was a fair bit of stuff that
T-shirts
Kay brought in as a result of doing an exhibit that focused on the Sandcastle building competition of the 80s.
Mm. In terms of the image you have of the collection and how it relates to the history of White Rock, are there elements of it that aren't there that you think are interesting, that they're absent from the collection, or something that you're kind of actively seeking out, or that you would really, really like to have in the collection? Other, you know, on top of something like, say, the bowling alley, or being more proactive?
Well, I think that Kate's exhibit of the Sandcastle... The Sandcastle building is kind of... Because we hosted the world competition at some, and it was a big thing. I mean, tens of thousands of people came here and slammed this little strip and filled this.
It's amazing to imagine.
To the point that they had to basically cut it, stop it, because it was becoming way too big. I mean, the crowds were, we've got photos that you could see that literally it is kind of claustrophobic how tight everybody is in the crowds.
Yeah.
And it was a really big going concern. And for people who've been long-term White Rock people, the Sandcastle competition is kind of people feel strongly about it.
Mm-hmm.
So having collections that reflect that, that we've recently brought in is sort of filling one of those needs of having something that this community is, and what I mean, there still are people who are very passionate about it, and potentially want to try and restart a scale down, they always go scale down versus scale.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you control that? If it's popular, people will come, and
yeah,
if people will come, this place will get slammed, and so it's that kind of, because we just aren't built. I mean, you see, it's a peninsula, and so there's not places for people to go, and not big tracts of land to park people on and stuff like that. So it's a really challenging the desire to have lots of people come, and then what happens when that actually happens.
Yeah.
There's another piece of the community that I'd like to actively work on getting as they've already mentioned to us that they have Clegg Lights. We have a community theater that's been in place for, I want to say, 60 years.
Okay.
And so working together with them to not just acquire pieces for the collection, but perhaps do an exhibit about the importance of the theater.
And the theater as a thing, even prior to the White Rock Players Club, which is the name of the group that's been around forever, but even before that, in terms of amateur theater, there were a number of sort of key groups that kind of defined the culture of White Rock in its early periods. One's the Women's Auxiliary, the other is like these amateur play groups, and I think the May Day one is probably the other, sort of the May Day group, because May Day was a big thing out here as well, and many years of like going right back to the like early 1910s, where they did it annually for large numbers of years, and it was a big thing. So all of that sort of defining the cultural life exists, and doing something with the White Rock Players Club is, because though I've only lived in White Rock now for about 4 years, my parents have been in this area for about 20 years plus. And when I was first visiting them, we started going to the annual Christmas pantomime that the White Rock Players Club does annually, even in their old building. Like, again, it's a whole history because they had this whole building that now has been totally, you know, renovated into the current, like, very nice professional theater. But it kind of is, it resonates with me, even as a sort of quote-unquote outsider, because it's one of the things of White Rock that I knew. Like, it was sort of like my touchstone is, like, the Christmas Panto. But it was that big of a thing in the community as well, like that. People just, like, that's what they did.
Taking my kids to the Christmas Panto for 26 years.
People who've lived here, the White Rock Players Club is really, again, one of those community groups that just resonates with tons of people. And so, yeah, we have to get some of their stuff. And some, you know, and document the histories of some of their key people. Like, there were some really key figures in terms of developing the plays and putting them on and staging them, that it'll be important for us to kind of document that.
How do you go about building an exhibition? What's your process with it? And what are some that you're thinking about
now? I'm expecting my process to change quite a bit, because I'm signed up in 2 weeks to go to Tim Willis's exhibit design and planning course at UVic. So I'm actually, as I say, sort of planning for my process to change as a result of that. But right now, my first exhibit was basically just out of necessity. We had those big cases, we can't really move them off site, and I need to put something in there. After we moved them to make room for our living languages. And also, as I said, it was within weeks of me starting. So that one was basically the mother of, necessity being the mother of my invention there, was just to find objects in our collection that related to the material of, you know, the cultures that the languages were representing, and, you know, just stuff it in there in a way that looked pretty. My next exhibit is going to be more, more meaty and toothy, and it is about the pier. And basically what I started is I kind of just think of sort of a topic I want to look into, and then I come at it with an open sort of mind to start researching. I've pulled like the archival files for the pier, and reading some books and stuff like that. And from sort of this early thing, I'm just beginning to germinate kind of the big question or the big sort of thing that I want the exhibit to look at. And what that is right now is just that over the course of the development of the pier, there were some key periods and times when you know, there were people here in White Rock that were advocating for the pier to become a much bigger going concern than it was, to be built out into a full docking wharf where, you know, like ferry ships could do, or more industrial. I mean, like, there were people pushing it, this to become kind of an industrial port, because it's actually very deep water, very, like, quite close to the shore.
Right, yeah.
So we have, you know, some of the perfect sort of setup for that kind of
and
thing.
It's concealed, too, in terms
yes,
of its exposure.
It's quite, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's quite sheltered, and but at the same time, very deep. You can get big boats into, big ships into it. And it could have been a, you know, offloading place for everything from cargo to people. And there have been, you know, as I say, people within the community advocating for that at various key points on the development of the pier. And for whatever reason, and this is where I want to do a bit more research, and it usually was the feds, it was either, like, not the right time, or they argued, well, you have to use it more to create the case for us to build it more. And it's like, well, we can't use it more because we can't use it for the thing that we want, because it's basically just kind of a, you know, and it always has been sort of a fairly lightweight pier. I mean, very long and that, but it was never built up in a way that you could have more than just, I mean, it had some day tripping kind of ships come in and unload people, but it wasn't like the kind of thing that you could really get, you know, industry or ferries or whatever to really start using. So it was always kind of like this catch 22, you know, if you build it, they will come, and then, well, we can't build it because they're not there. It's like, ugh.
It's almost
so it never
this
really
history
happened.
Of the aspiration. In a
exactly.
Way, what
and I
want
to kind of just put it out to the community that if at any one of these times, one of these changes had happened and the pier had developed either as a ferry kind of terminal or as a, you know, full industrial, what would the nature of White Rock be today? We wouldn't be the little, you know, sort of summer village on the sea kind of thing, which I think is the how people even now think of White Rock, like, you know, not only from outside, but even inside. Lots of people, you know, as White Rock, because it's so small of a community, you know, bounded by Surrey on, like, is, you know, so there's still a lot of people who don't want, like, the towers to be built up, and yet the city needs some way of, you know, ensuring the tax revenue doesn't get stagnant. So there's lots of push and pull, but I think largely people want to preserve sort of that sort of, you know, summer village, summer, you know, kind of, even though most people are permanent residents or buildings are empty because they're in, you know, like, it's foreign investors who've purchased them, that kind of thing. But it's, you know, so as I say, kind of like as I'm approaching this pier thing, I've now kind of got this question in mind. Now it's just a case, can I find the research to tell that story in a way that has people coming out of the exhibit going like, yeah, what if? Like, what if White Rock was more like Tawasin? What if White Rock was more like, you know, Burrard Inlet? I mean, we probably, Vancouver was always a big going concern already as a docking area, even throughout the entire formation of White Rock. So it was never going to be like this competed with that. But it certainly could have been more, much more developed as a, you know.
And perhaps, so. I mean, I from what I understand, they're now staging freighters in Saturna and places like this because the harbor itself in Vancouver is max capacity
exactly.
almost all the time.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it's something that may even continue to
right now, I think,
come up again.
Yeah, but I think now it would be opposed, whereas at that point, you know, at these times it was actually advocated by the city. Oh, please build us up. Please, you know, we want people to come here. We want to be a ferry terminal. We want to be a whatever.
Yeah.
And now I think people would, you know, take out hammer and tong and start, you know, beating on politicians if they started saying, you know, let's build up this place.
That's interesting.
So it's just kind of a, I think, a story that has never been told. Like, we've told the story of the history of the pier a few times over the course of the museum, but I think this kind of one that just has it, you know, and I think that's partly because my training is not as a historian, I'm an anthropologist, so cultural dynamics is kind of my thing. So I kind of come at the information somewhat differently and kind of do the whole, like, where would we be if one of these decisions had been made at any one of these periods?
Something I had forgotten to mention a little bit earlier, we talked about this, about the movement of the museum and the initial donation a couple of times. What mm-hmm. what was the history of the White Rock Museum being in this location, and what have been some of the other locations that it has been in?
Okay, because this building was a train station up until the late 70s. And when they stopped running the trains through here, BNSF sold this building to the city of White Rock for the sum of $1 on condition that it remain a cultural and heritage building. It could never be used for commercial purposes. And so the museum was in here for a period of time, and then it was relocated up to the brick building, up the old bank up the way. And then there was a cultural, like, guild in here, so they had Weaver's Guild, Potter's Guild, and it was used as an art center. And then it was decided to return it back to a museum. And then our renovations were done in late 2011, bringing it up to museum standards and with climate and humidity, environmental controls. So.
Where do you see the White Rock Museum in 5 years, 10 years? What are some of the aspirations that you have for the collections and exhibitions? And
oh wow, I'm pretty ambitious.
I am too, but I'll let you go first.
I'm really, really pleased with how things have turned around. And I think I sat on the board for 10 years and witnessed things and probably didn't really have a full appreciation of what we could be and should be doing. And so I made some significant changes in the past 3 years. And with the support of somebody who has that background and experience, I'm really pleased to see us going in this new direction. And I know my staff, Hugh, is delighted with how things have changed. And we are going to be the best small little museum in the area. Mm. And I hope that we get... we have 30,000 people come through the doors every year. And that's significant because that's larger than the population of White Rock. A lot of it is due to being on the water. Our location is our best asset. It's also our best competition. When it's nice out, people are not necessarily going to come into the museum.
Although the climate controlled would be nice to
come
down.
On a hot
down.
Day.
Yes.
but when you're this close to the water, it rarely is, like, so super hot.
Yeah.
Right.
So I want to see more of the community come here. We have people come in through the RWOP program, which I mentioned to you, who have lived here their whole lives and never set foot in this place. And so I want people to have a real appreciation for this museum and what it represents, and encourage people to tell their stories. Encourage them to make this museum part of their ability to share that history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have largely the same aspirations, but in terms of actually making it happen, some of the things that I want to see us do is what I call the museumification of White Rock. I'm not ambitious at all. I want, because we're such a small, like, physical space, but we don't need to be a small museum in a small physical space. So basically it's looking at opportunities. There already are things. We've got the museum worked with the city, and we're also one of these unique situations where we are still a independent not-for-profit society that are the stewards of a city collection, because most of the museums that are in that kind of situation have either become fully adopted by the city or have died because the society can't keep it going anymore. We're in a fairly good position. We do get about half of our annual funding provided to us by the city each year, but we self-generate the other half of the funding. So we've got some really good fundraising. But anyways, moving past just like our sort of that we're in kind of a stable situation here as a not-for-profit, but still independent of the city, is we do have a good working relationship with the city, and they recognize, especially recently, that wasn't always the case, but recently I think they've seen that we're really taking on sort of our heritage role. And so we're working with the city on things like there are interpretive panels on the pier, and if you look closely at them, they are branded both City of White Rock and the museum, because they were developed as a project together. And we want to do more of that and get more interpretive sort of places and signs around the city. There was also, quite a number of years ago, the rock thing started.
Heritage stones.
Like, in terms of the what time period that was, like the late 90s, early 2000s?
Early 2000s.
Yeah. So there are these heritage stones, I think 8 or 9 of them around town at, like, the United Church was one. And they're just kind of small, on a stone close to the thing. In many cases, people wouldn't even notice them. And they kind of look pretty rough now, because of the technology at that time. Most of it, I think, is plexi on a thing, and water's gotten in and, you know, that kind of stuff. But we're already in conversation with the city to update those. And I'd like to expand the program and, again, look at, we've lost a number of heritage buildings. That's a project that's pretty close to Hugh's heart. He did a bit of an inventory a few years ago. And again, we're currently working with the city. Right now, we've got a city council that does care about heritage and the heritage feel of White Rock, and I think recognizes how that makes us kind of a unique community on the Lower Mainland and gives us something that is our own, so that we don't just become, you know, kind of a cookie cutter looking community. So I think they're looking at ways of, like, preserving our heritage features, drawing out our heritage features, you know, potentially working even more with Marine Drive and, you know, sort of beautifying it and that kind of stuff, but still keeping some of the things that make White Rock, you know, cool. Mm. And so, you know, so we're already talking with ways that we can kind of, you know, there are, like, all of the street names have pretty much been taken, but there are laneways and alleyways throughout the community, some of which are historically, like, were historically named, but they're not official names. I mean, they're just, you know, sort of documenting people's heads. So we're looking at a program of taking those names and making them real, mm-hmm. and putting them out so that Cosmic Alley is actually then named Cosmic Alley, and it's not just a bunch of, you know, hippies from the 60s going, like, that's Cosmic Alley. Mm-hmm. So it becomes Cosmic Alley and is named that. And then there's some sort of feature there that says why it's named Cosmic Alley and what is its history of being called that. Mm. Where did it come from? You know.
Do you get a sense that the population, that it was a process to start thinking about White Rock as a place of historical event?
It is becoming that. I mean, like, I think this is the first time this city council has established a historic and heritage committee to advise them, that has people that sit on it from the board and the staff of the museum, but including other members of the community, who are like local historians and people interested in history for various reasons. And so that advisory committee is a new thing that was the city undertaking that themselves. So yeah, I think this heritage awareness is something that the current council thinks is important. It didn't exist in the previous council. The previous council was really like focused on development. Didn't really appreciate some of the other unique features. We haven't really talked about the Semiamu people, but. Mm-hmm. You know, the previous council did not have a good relationship, and again, the current council is doing a lot of activity to try and, repair the damage that was done there.
Yeah.
And likewise the museum, because again, historically we lost some of the objects that they had loaned to the museum. And so just this past year, the city and the museum undertook an apology ceremony with the Sami-Yem people to try and mend some of that broken relationship. And we're hoping, you know, to develop that so that we can work more closely with that community, you know.
And you mentioned that there were some projects that are afoot with the Sami-Yem people to develop their own
potentially
center,
like, I don't know that that's true, but I do know that they have a lot of ambition for sort of the land that they're on. Again, there's long-standing issues with getting you know, potable water there, and then also I know part of the whole argument is at what scale is it, the scale for them to service their current community there, or is it at a scale that will allow them to, you know, expand and, you know, put in a hotel and, you know, like those kinds of things. Those are, you know, some of the you know, they're even still part of the current tension points is that. But at the same time, you know, we don't want, like, our role isn't to kind of get involved in that at all. It's both basically to maintain open to relationship and to you know, currently steward the materials that we do have, because we still do have quite a bit of material on loan from the Sami-Yem, and making sure that we treat it respectfully, and it's here if they ever do then want to do something, and to be here as a support and open to work, you know, with them, but in whatever capacity that they want to, because it's a very small community. They only have so many people, and they are involved in all kinds of things. From, I mean, interestingly enough, in terms of the connection with the current exhibit, language is one of the big things that they're currently, you know, trying to work on within their community. They're losing some of their last natives, you know, like fluent speakers, and you know, so they are really working very hard, and that's a main focus. So obviously, you know, they only have so much room on their dance card for undertaking, you know, all kinds of projects. So it's more like just being being a receptive, open partner,
yeah,
if they want, but not, you know, sort of saying like, we want to do this and we want to do that and
yeah,
blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
But there's also a huge opportunity in terms of working with that community, because they are becoming, you know, like, their leadership has changed. When did Harley, he's been chief for,
yeah,
for quite a while now.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's very open to, you know, establishing better relationships with the community. Obviously, there's still trust issues. There's still, you know, past history that is being dealt with. But I think right now we've got a set of players that want to deal with it and want to accept, you know, their roles in what happened before, and aren't just kind of, you know, doing the whole, like, yeah, you know,
yeah,
we didn't do it and we don't have a responsibility to fix it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever was the block before, I think we are in a much better place now, but it, you know, that could change. Again, I mean, with the city council, they're elected every four years. And I think most people are pretty happy with how this council is doing, so I hope they come back in. Just speaking personally.
Well,
but,
and it seems that,
you know,
if,
cause it's,
with the outreach and engagement with the community, then it becomes, you can bypass that mediation, and then there becomes public support, hopefully, to the to the initiatives that you're trying to spearhead.
And I think we're going to be sort of well positioned in terms of, you know, like where the museum is in terms of its kind of civic support, and getting back to sort of some of the ongoing plans. I mean, we do have, right now we have a little satellite exhibit that we can put on in the White Rock Library. So we are actually, just next Thursday, we'll be putting on a little exhibit there. One of my volunteers, I've assigned her to sort of curate it as her first sort of foray into full curatorial stuff with my support. Well, again, it's connected with our living languages.
Okay.
So but basically, she's kind of doing a mini library version of what I did in the thing, and just choosing some materials
nice.
that are sort of robust enough to be in the library for a few months, where we don't sort of control the light and the temperature and that. But she's chosen, you know, like some baskets that are in really good quality, you know, good condition. They won't be damaged by a couple months over in the library.
Mm.
And, you know, a couple of other little pieces to go in there. And we'll do the label text this week and get it installed. But actually, it's this week that the install is. But, I mean, I also got... Yeah, exactly. It's this week. But I'm looking for other opportunities, you know, potentially looking at when, like, retail space is left open, whether we could have relationships with that would allow us to kind of go in and use it with no charge, but make it look pretty so that it still doesn't just look like a boarded up shop, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. That's great.
Sort of take over the town.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to sit down, and look forward to hearing more in the future.
It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah.